We thought about the Pentagon ceremony and wondered if my husband had been set up. Were the full military honors to give the appearance of Hussein's complicity or approval of their actions? The next surprise came from the PLO. The second phase of the peace talks had deadlocked in Washington and had been rescued by a Norwegian diplomat, so the Palestinians and the Israelis had been meeting secretly in Oslo. Suddenly, out of the blue, Washington announced in August that the PLO and Israel had reached a declaration of principles and an interim peace agreement. The king was furious. Yasser Arafat had told my husband that he had been in touch with Shimon Peres, but it turned out that the Palestinians and the Israelis had been meeting secretly for months. Shimon Peres, too, had not said a word about it. "Why not coordinate?" my husband said. "How can we possibly work this way?" Hussein recovered quickly from his shock, however, and within 24 hours he endorsed the interim Oslo agreement. "This is what the Palestinians want, and the only thing I can do is support them," he said. Privately, though, Hussein thought the Palestinians had given away too much. The king had refused to bargain away any Palestinian rights to territory occupied since 1967, yet the wording of the Oslo agreement was so vague that it was unclear what lands the agreement would provide the Palestinians. More troubling to Hussein was that all the truly substantive issues involving the status of Jerusalem, refugees, settlements, security arrangements, borders and relations, and cooperation with neighbors were not addressed. Instead, they were postponed for further negotiation within 3 years. On the positive side, with the announcement of the Palestinian-Israeli interim accord, the way was now clear for King Hussein to work toward Jordan's own agreement with Israel. Because Arafat had made the first move, however flawed, Hussein felt free to proceed. While talks commenced with Israel, it was with heavy hearts that we began another, more personal, transitional event, the delivery of our eldest son, Hamza, to boarding school in England. Hamza had been registered at Harrow since the day he was born. The housemaster of Hussein's house, the park, where he boarded, had been visiting Jordan at the time of his birth and had immediately put Hamza's name down for the class of 1998. Hamza's leaving home was an extraordinary wrench for all of us, just as it had been when Abir, Haya, and Ali had left for studies in England. But it was time for him as well to experience life beyond the hothouse of the royal court. I had hoped that Hamza would go to school in the United States, because I thought the American educational system was more flexible, but Hamza wanted to follow in his father's path. Harrow would turn out to be an excellent match for him, however painful it was for us at the beginning. Hamza had inherited his father's love of flying, and it was he who flew me into London by helicopter in early September to meet up with his father on our way to Harrow. There were errands beforehand that would become routine, a visit to the orthodontist and the barber, then lunch at the grill room at the Dorchester Hotel, where his father introduced Hamza to his favorite meal from his own student days, hamburgers topped with fried eggs. Neither of them was in the least bit responsive to my maternal comments about cholesterol, and Hamza immediately adopted his father's favorite student meal as his own. Hamza and his father were very much alike, which led later to a great deal of speculation in the country that my husband would choose him as his successor. I discouraged such talk at every turn, because I did not think it served any constructive purpose, and it put Hamza in a difficult position where other family members were concerned. The succession would depend on God's will and my husband's judgment, as well as on constitutional considerations. My responsibility as mother, wife, and queen was to encourage all the children to develop their own individual talents, and to prepare to serve their country in whatever fashion they were most suited, with humility and devotion. No one should expect only a future of royal privilege. As we prepared to leave him that first day of school, Hamza waved goodbye to us bravely. It was I who began to dissolve as we drove away, as I had with each of the older children. Hamza missed us terribly at first, which he tried hard to disguise, but it was obvious to his father. Within a week, Hussein and I went back to Harrow, after an agonizing debate over whether or not our visit would make life more difficult for our son. Both Hamza and his father perked up over another meal of hamburgers and fried eggs, and the two of them teased me, a sure sign that Hamza's mood had improved. All of us felt better after the visit. My husband subsequently wrote Hamza a loving and affirming letter, explaining his plan for a family council to elect a successor, and urging him to understand the importance of his education in preparing him for his future role, whatever it might be. It was a private communication from father to son, and no more was said about it. But Hamza settled down at Harrow and did very well. We flew back to Jordan from London on September 13, or Super Monday, as my husband called it, because Arafat and Rabin were in Washington signing Oslo I. Our own peace process was moving forward as well. 24 hours later, Jordan and Israel signed an agenda for peace at the State Department in Washington, D.C. The spotlight on Arafat shone also on his wife, Suha, who was not in Washington with him, but was interviewed extensively on CNN. I had sent her a message of support, and she called me soon after to thank me and to ask for advice in what she described as a very difficult time for her. She is already being subjected to the same plague of gossip and rumors that all of us cope with in these positions, I wrote in my journal. It was extraordinary how merciless the criticism was. I have heard that same gossip about so many different people, and even about us, and I know these kinds of stories circulate with no basis in fact whatsoever, I said to her critics. Why not give her a chance? Try for once to give the benefit of the doubt. I tried to share with Suha whatever wisdom I had come by as a 12-year veteran of Middle East politics. Focus on what you can contribute, and let all the rest of it go, I advised Suha. Just get in there and do your best. The inevitable gossip and rumors are not important, as long as you know you are serving your people to the best of your ability. 2 weeks after Arafat and Rabin signed the interim agreement in Washington, the Israeli Prime Minister came to Aqaba for a secret meeting with my husband. Given the sensitivity of the situation, we kept a minimal staff presence at the house, and our house manager and I attended to every detail of the preparations. My most distinct memory of that meeting was the sound of Rabin's deep, sonorous voice for what seemed hours on end. It was at this meeting that the two leaders would begin to know each other and to establish the personal trust and respect, differences notwithstanding, that would lead to our peace accord with Israel. Jordan had supported every constructive peace effort since 1967, but time and again we had been frustrated or betrayed. Sometimes both. We were exhausted by all the turmoil, political upheaval, and suffering of what were now generations of Palestinians, not to mention the corrosive sense of insecurity and all the obstacles to economic development and progress in the region. Hussein and Rabin agreed not to publicly announce their contact in pursuit of peace, mostly because their positions were so far apart, and they wanted to wait until they had something substantive to offer. Slowly and painstakingly, they examined every position to see where progress could be made. Our relationship with the Israelis had, at times, bordered on the absurd. At international conferences, we had to be constantly vigilant not to have any inappropriate contact with any Israeli participants, and certainly not to be photographed with them. We knew that the Israelis could use those images for political purposes, giving an impression of normalization that would be interpreted on the Arab street as fraternizing with the enemy. Yet somehow there always seemed to be Israelis poised to ambush us, wherever we might be, with camera in hand. This sensitivity made for one very awkward international conference of first ladies, when the de rigueur official group photograph had to be taken. It was customary to arrange the delegates alphabetically by country, which was fine if there were representatives from Jamaica or Japan separating Jordan from Israel. This time neither country was represented. I was placed next to Mrs. Weizmann, the wife of Israel's president Ezer Weizmann, who talked to me with great animation throughout the entire group photography session. I responded by looking straight ahead into the camera and talking to her out of the corner of my mouth, trying hard not to be impolite. Avoiding mediagenic contact was absolutely necessary at that point, although we knew dialogue was essential, and it was against our natures to have to avoid contact in these ways. A rare exception was the wheelchair games of disabled service members the King opened in England in the summer of 1993. We all applauded the entrance of the teams from Jordan, Israel, Britain, South America, and the United States. After the wheelchair games, we shook hands with the disabled servicemen and posed for photographs with all of them, including the Israelis, despite the taboo. It seems insane that men must enlist, fight, and be injured in order to communicate with the enemy on a human level, my husband said to me later. In the last months of 1993 and the beginning of 1994, the situation in the Middle East was particularly unsettled. I was in New York in November addressing a conference on women at Columbia University when an incident occurred that added to the tensions. President Clinton met with Salman Rushdie in the White House, albeit in a corridor, not the Oval Office. Rushdie had been condemned by the Ayatollah Khomeini a few years earlier for the way he wrote about the Prophet Muhammad in his novel Satanic Verses, a condemnation of his blasphemy that was widely accepted by Muslims all over the world, although many did not agree with his death sentence. In the West, however, various groups of Western writers, most notably the organization PEN, had sprung to Rushdie's defense, arguing that any censure or even criticism of Rushdie impinged on the constitutional right of everyone to freedom of speech. Clinton's meeting with Rushdie in the White House was obviously not a chance event. No one just happens to bump into the president in a corridor of the White House. Iran immediately blasted the Clinton meeting with Rushdie, and violent demonstrations broke out in other Muslim countries, including Bangladesh and Pakistan. The State Department issued warnings to U.S. citizens living or traveling in Muslim countries, which was hardly helpful to tourism. While Americans were thinking about Clinton's meeting with Rushdie as a constitutional issue, Muslims were viewing it as a gratuitous insult. Even my husband was very upset about it and called me from Jordan. "Hamas and extremists will use it," I wrote in my journal. "We need to ensure that those who might benefit from it and demonize relations between the United States and the Arab Muslim world are not able to exploit the situation that has been created by the meeting." I called Hillary Clinton to register our concerns, but trying to get anyone's attention was a major challenge in Washington at the time. Scandals such as Lorena Bobbitt's attack on her husband, Tanya Harding's on a fellow ice skater, O.J. Simpson's murder trial, and the all-consuming topic of Monica Lewinsky dominated headlines and made productive dialogue about anything else very difficult. For people living outside the United States, America's extraordinary obsession with what seemed like minor events was puzzling and frustrating. In Jordan and the Middle East, we were facing life and death issues on a daily basis. Many Palestinians objected to Arafat's peace negotiations with Israel, while others were opposed to Jordan's pursuit of the same goal. Islamic extremists were responsible for a series of explosions in movie theaters. Our first secretary at the Jordanian embassy in Lebanon was assassinated, and on February 25, 30 Palestinian worshippers were massacred by a Jewish settler in the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron. Nevertheless, negotiations with the Israelis stayed on track. The King had been working directly with Rabin for nearly a year on a workable framework for peace, and by mid-July 1994, the agreement was almost ready. Jordanian-Israeli subcommittees were successfully reaching understandings on water, the environment, and energy. Bilateral negotiations between the two countries were progressing on borders, other territorial matters, and security. On July 25, King Hussein and Prime Minister Rabin were scheduled to sign a declaration of intent to formally end the 46-year state of war between the two countries and begin the final path to peace. Even the choice of location was settled. Hussein had selected Wadi Araba for the signing of the declaration, a fitting choice because of its position on Jordan's border with Israel. Marking this step forward in the region in this way would clearly demonstrate our independent commitment to a comprehensive peace. The king had written President Clinton to give him the still highly confidential news of the agreement and to inform him of the date and site. We thought all was in place. But we were wrong. We were in Aqaba on July 15. Hussein, having visited army units and the specific location for the Wadi Araba meetings, when he heard from Warren Christopher that the United States not only wanted to delay the meeting between the Jordanian and Israeli leaders, but also wanted it to take place in Washington, not Jordan. The king felt that the meeting should take place in Jordan, not at the White House, like some media replay of Arafat's meeting with Rabin. "Follow your instincts," I told him. "Don't let anyone hijack this critical historic moment for their own short-term political benefit." The United States responded by dangling all sorts of financial incentives, including the forgiveness of Jordan's crippling $700 million debt. In the end, the king had no choice. "This is the only time I've ever compromised for profit to the country," he said. But I was skeptical about the American offer. Promises of debt relief were one thing, but there were no guarantees. And here we were in the process of losing control over our own declaration of peace with Israel. Hussein and I were at lunch in Aqaba the next day, when we were informed that Clinton was about to break the secrecy of the negotiations and announce the upcoming meeting in Washington. I was so agitated that I could not eat. Neither of us had any idea what Clinton was going to say. It was surreal to listen to the live television announcement that Jordan would be signing a declaration to end the state of war between itself and Israel, while knowing that Hussein had not been consulted or briefed on the details in advance. Only after the news announcement did we learn that the official trip included a banquet, a White House ceremony, and an invitation for both the king and Rabin to address a joint session of the U.S. Congress, which was especially significant. I had long lobbied for just such an opportunity. It would be a very effective way for Hussein to take his vision of peace directly to U.S. decision-makers. After months of secrecy, history was made on July 18, 1994, when Fayez Taraune, our ambassador in Washington and head of the Jordanian delegation to the peace talks, and Eliakim Rubinstein, the head of the Israeli delegation, appeared together in Wadi Araba to announce the commencement of final peace negotiations between our two countries. Fayez and Eli Rubinstein trading jokes in shirt sleeves, an amazing sight, I wrote in my journal. The Jerash festival opened in the midst of all these historic events, and somehow Hussein found the time to open it officially with me, a remarkable gesture under the circumstances, and a source of excitement for all of Jerash. I think he chose to come to the opening to seize the opportunity to interact with different groups of Jordanians while the meetings were taking place with the Israelis, at a moment when he would be leading Jordan into an entirely new era. A Jordanian delegation, including our nephew, Talal, had traveled ahead to Washington to lay the groundwork for the upcoming events and to iron out any problems before they arose. Talal, who had become my husband's military secretary after the Gulf War, went to the U.S. State Department to confirm the assurances that had been given to my husband and was told that Jordan would indeed receive everything that had been promised, including the squadron of F-16 fighter jets that Congress had been denying my husband now for several years. Talal also went to Capitol Hill, where he received a completely different answer. "Absolutely not," he was told. "You are not getting a thing unless you sign a full treaty with Israel right now, not just an end to the state of war. You are signing a framework for peace, for your sake, not ours, so don't expect to receive any rewards from us." Talal had just sent off an optimistic cable to the king, reiterating the assurances from the State Department, when he had to quickly fire off a second cable. "Disregard previous message. Congress says no. What shall we do?" It was a critical moment. If King Hussein was to come back empty-handed from Washington, it would be a disaster for Jordan, and would almost certainly derail the peace process at the 11th hour. The king immediately called Talal and said, "I'll speak to Rabin, and you make contact with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee." Talal was not familiar with the members of AIPAC, so he phoned his doctor, who he knew was well-connected and might be able to help. "Yes," his doctor responded. "I know the president of the organization, Steve Grossman. I'll put you in touch." Within minutes, Steve Grossman called Talal, who explained the impasse and its urgency, since the White House ceremony was only 3 days away. "I would love to help you, but I have to get the go-ahead from the Israelis first," Grossman said. Hussein had reached Prime Minister Rabin by then, and Talal was very relieved when Steve Grossman called him back to say, "The Israelis have given me the green light. Rabin himself told me to do whatever is necessary to help the Jordanians, and I promise you that Congress will pass your bill. I cannot tell how many votes you'll get, but your bill will pass." It was a stunning example of AIPAC's power. The bill would end up being tacked onto an agriculture spending bill and going quietly before the Senate at 1 a.m., when C-SPAN was off the air. In 3 days, Patrick Griffin, Clinton's assistant for legislative affairs, got the measure passed. 1 squadron of F-16s for Jordan and a $700 million debt forgiven. We arrived in Washington a few days before the signing to find ourselves under siege again. The Middle East experts at the State Department were furiously demanding that my husband show them what was becoming known as the Washington Declaration. But Hussein refused to show the agreement to anyone, including Warren Christopher. So intent was the king to prevent any possible leaks that might endanger the agreement that he waited until late the night before the signing, after all the newspapers had put their morning editions to bed, to send the text to the White House. We were still working on last-minute edits to Hussein's speech to the joint session of Congress as we sped on July 25, 1994, toward the meeting with Rabin at the White House, where we turned an extraordinary new page of our destiny. We were greeted by the President and Hillary Clinton and taken to our respective Israeli partners for what was, predictably, a media circus. "Mrs. Rabin is quite tough and aggressive," I recorded in my journal. "We eye each other from a distance and keep the conversation social." It was a typically hot summer day in Washington, as my husband and Prime Minister Rabin signed the Washington Declaration, ending a 46-year state of war with Israel. Hussein's remarks on the White House lawn were deeply moving. He always spoke best when he did so from the heart, and this occasion was perhaps his finest moment. "For many, many years, and with every prayer, I have asked God the Almighty to help me be a part of forging peace between the children of Abraham," he said. "This was the dream of generations before me, and now I see it realized." Among the crowd surrounding the three leaders after the ceremony was Avraham Daskal, an Israeli who had been invited to Amman 58 years earlier by his friend King Abdullah to celebrate the birth of Abdullah's grandson, Hussein, whom Daskal had last seen as a newborn. Although the Israelis were jubilant to be signing a framework for peace with an Arab neighbor, my enthusiasm was tempered by worries. While I was elated for my husband, I knew that his mind, too, was thousands of miles away, in Jordan. For Israel, the declaration represented the completion of a specific objective. But for us, it was simply a continuing part of a process, a landmark on the rocky road toward a comprehensive peace in the region. The Washington Declaration stated the five underlying principles agreed to by Hussein and Rabin. Among them, negotiations based on UN Resolutions 242 and 338, and the right of each state to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries. One controversial principle was the inclusion of Israel's respect for Jordan's special and historic role in the Muslim holy shrines in Jerusalem, and Israel's agreement to give high priority to Jordan's continuing guardianship during Israel's permanent status negotiations with the Palestinians. As we learned at the banquet that evening, this recognition of the Hashemites' continuing spiritual role in Arab East Jerusalem incensed Yasser Arafat. East Jerusalem was, of course, occupied territory, which the Palestinians were claiming as their capital, and Arafat wanted control of the holy sites. But there were no provisions in the Oslo agreements about the sacred sites, and until other arrangements were made for their protection, my husband felt it necessary to ensure that Jordan maintain its historic guardianship of the holy sites where his great-grandfather was buried, his grandfather had been assassinated, and so many Jordanian soldiers had been killed defending Arab East Jerusalem in 1967. As King Hussein said in his address to Congress the next day, he believed strongly that sovereignty over the holy places should reside with God alone, and should be extended to all the children of Abraham, be they Muslim, Jew, or Christian. For the first time, direct phone links would be opened between Israel and Jordan. Our respective electricity grids would be shared to conserve resources. An international air corridor would be opened to facilitate commercial exchanges and tourism, and two new border crossings would be opened, one at the southern tip of Aqaba Eilat, the other to be determined. All in all, the provisions of the declaration were a very promising step toward the final negotiations still to come. The joint session of Congress was dramatic. The king's words were greeted by standing ovations. Rabin's speech was also very well received. It was an eye-opener for members of our delegation to see firsthand the seemingly magical hold Israel had on the American political psyche. Representatives and senators were offering warm, enthusiastic congratulations to the king, but they were greeting Prime Minister Rabin as if they were the oldest of friends. That dynamic was working in our favor, however. Israel was now actively supporting the Jordanian peace initiative. As long as Rabin was alive, our government would have a much easier time rallying the support of Congress. Rabin was consistent in advocating support for Jordan, recognizing that sustainable peace could be reached only with an equal stakeholder, a principle we believed that had to apply to the Palestinians as well. Rabin also knew Jordan. He had fought against Jordan. He also knew Jordanians, having been born and raised just across the Jordan River. Many Israelis did not have this perspective. Whereas members of our government knew a great deal about the Israelis and their internal politics, who was a minister, who was a mayor, their counterparts knew little about us. To most Israelis, we were all just Arabs. They did not know how different we are from one another, or our cultural terms of reference, or what our concerns are. The Israeli equation was a simple one. The good Arabs were the ones who talked to Israel, the bad Arabs were the ones who did not. After the signing, our image changed virtually overnight, it seemed. And suddenly, even for our traditionally sternest critics, we could do no wrong. After a brief stop in England, we received news that the Israelis had given us a flight plan to overfly Israel and take the most direct route to Amman. Israeli airspace had always been off-limits. Indeed, all of Israel had been off-limits. My husband's closest advisers were extremely anxious about changing our flight plan, but Hussein was determined to do so. We did not tell the crew or anyone else on board the TriStar until we were in the air between the Greek coast and Cyprus, where two Israeli F-15 fighter escorts joined us. Suddenly, Tel Aviv and the coastline lay in front of us, unimaginably, stretching north and south. We could see congested traffic on the highways and suburban sprawl, manicured, affluent-looking. As we flew over Tel Aviv, Rabin and my husband gave a joint radio address in which we were heartened to hear Rabin speak of Jerusalem as a city of peace for all future generations. It gives me hope in the midst of the snowballing pace of events. Hussein appears to be on such a high of emotion that I pray there will be no letdown, that we are not simply pawns in a game in which we may lose our value once we have given everything, I noted in my journal. As we flew on, leaving Israel behind us, over hills and valleys dotted with settlements, suddenly, gloriously, the golden dome of the rock appeared directly ahead. It was an unbelievable sight as we approached it, glowing in the afternoon light. So familiar to me, yet I was seeing it for the first time. Gazing at the dome was an extraordinary moment for me, and even more so for all the Jordanians on the flight, who had not been able to see or visit the mosque since 1967. Some wept, others prayed. What feelings must be overwhelming Hussein, so close to the dome for the first time in 27 years, I wrote in my journal. In this moment, I see none of the ugly new construction surrounding the old city, nor even the house Hussein started building before 1967 that was never completed. I see only the peaceful site of the mosque and its courtyard, which appear to be lit from within. Hussein circled the mosque as we flew lower and lower until we were barely at 1,000 feet. It was an incredible moment, documented by an Israeli aerial photographer codenamed Peace Fox on one of the Israeli jet escorts. It reinforced my sense that we were embarking on a new path with unique spiritual goals. Even now, when I look at the photograph of the huge TriStar flying over Israel with the golden Hashemite crown on the tail and the gray, blue, and red livery, I am overcome with emotion. I went directly to the Zerash festival as soon as we landed in Jordan to get a feeling for the mood of the people. So much had happened so quickly and so many miles away that I wanted to see for myself how it was being received. It was Hussein's nature to act intuitively and sometimes impulsively, but always from the heart. Perhaps because of his recent physical ordeal, I was feeling particularly protective of him during the peace process, and very conscious of the different points of view that would influence the vital peace-building after the treaties were signed. I was therefore especially relieved to find at Zerash and elsewhere in the country the usual atmosphere of support and affection. Hussein would need all that and more to lead the country successfully through the negotiations that still lay ahead with Israel, and to accept the dramatic changes that were already taking place. Less than 2 weeks after the signing of the Washington Declaration, we went to Aqaba to prepare for the inauguration of the first open crossing point between Jordan and Israel. Warren Christopher flew in for the historic event on August 8, along with his wife and several other U.S. officials. Israel sent a huge delegation, including Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, members of the Israeli army, and the media. Our home was host to an army of Israeli politicians, generals, and journalists. A press conference was held outside the house, and the extraordinary size and unknown makeup of the throng of reporters made our security-conscious sons wary. Hamza and Hashim keep a watchful eye on their father, while Mrs. Christopher and the ladies watch the press conference harem-like from an upstairs window of the house, I wrote in my journal. Telephone lines between the two countries, mandated by the Washington Declaration, had also just opened. The ceremonial first conversation, which took place on August 6 between my husband and Ezer Weizmann, Israel's president, opened floodgates of pent-up communication between families on both sides of the Jordan River. Israeli and Jordanian delegations immediately resumed negotiations toward a final peace, but despite the progress made by the declaration, there were no guarantees that they would achieve it. Decades of bitterness and mistrust had to be overcome, along with the aftermath of three devastating wars. My husband and I remained optimistic, but cautious. We had lived through so many failed attempts that made for great media opportunities, but without achieving any lasting peace. We could not afford to repeat that experience. It was critical from our perspective that the areas of cooperation with Israel outlined in the Washington Declaration produce tangible benefits, not only for the Jordanian people, but also for regional progress. Around this time, my husband and I finally identified a possible new place to live. The new house was in a royal residential compound just outside Amman, where we had stayed for a few weekends with the children to escape the congestion of the city. Known as Darat al-Khair, or House of Blessing, the house, which had many happy memories for my husband, had a lovely view over the cities of Salt and Jerash, and, most important to Hussein, was far from the Diwan. He had finally settled his siblings, his nephews, and his older children, so the way was clear for the youngest seven and the two of us. I worked with a renowned Jordanian architect, Rasem Badran, on a design that would allow our entire family to be together without destroying the integrity of the original building. Unfortunately, the final beautiful design, a cluster of family spaces that resembled a traditional Jordanian village, would have required too much time for construction. We decided instead to renovate a slightly larger house that our nephew Talal and his brother Ghazi had grown up in, for ourselves, and Darat al-Khair became the home of Talal and his wife, Khida. I had worked with a number of architects on plans for a home on various alternative sites. This time, I did something different. Instead of making the house big enough for all the children, and thus creating a white elephant for any smaller family in the future, I decided to add a separate building to the plan that would offer the older children a degree of independence. I hoped this would take us all through the years and allow us to adapt to the changing needs of the family once the children began to grow up and leave home. I also developed a landscape design that would give the house the natural outdoor space that my husband loved so much. I worked hard on designing a separate sunken rock garden for him outside his office, where he could have private conversations or just be alone. Before we moved into it, my husband named the house Baba Salam, the Gate of Peace, after one of the entrances to Masjid al-Haram al-Sharif, the great mosque in Mecca. Meanwhile, the king was working very hard with Prime Minister Rabin on the final details of a peace agreement. We had never been this close to an agreement before, and he would never have a better partner than Rabin. King Hussein described their relationship as that between two military men who dealt directly and often bluntly with each other. Rabin and my husband were also able to see issues from each other's perspective. The negotiating question was always, "If I were you, could I live with that?" They both knew that peace was not made between governments, but between people, and whatever agreement they arrived at had to answer the needs of both populations in order to stand the test of time. Neither one of them wanted to sign a piece of paper, shake hands, and watch the peace collapse. And by the middle of October, they were very, very close. On the evening of October 16, I hugged my husband and wished him good luck as he left to meet with Rabin at Hashimiya to try to work out the final details. It was a very long night. When the phone rang early the next morning, I had no idea what to expect, until I heard Hussein's exhausted but jubilant voice. "I have wonderful news," he said. "We made it!" Hussein touched me greatly when he added that my encouragement had pushed him through to the end. How far we had all come, and how fast. Life in Jordan had been a roller coaster before, but now it had accelerated to a breathless pace. The intricate day-by-day negotiations of the Washington Declaration were behind us. Now, after 3 months of negotiating the painstaking details, the king and Rabin had dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. The peace treaty to which Hussein had dedicated so much of his life was finally ready. Within a week, we were back in Aqaba, this time preparing for the arrival of the Clintons and a host of dignitaries for the signing of the Jordan-Israeli peace treaty on October 26. Hussein and I were both enveloped by a strange calm and sense of destiny. This is a day like no other in terms of hopes, in terms of promise, and in terms of determination, my husband declared. It is the dawning of the era of peace, mutual respect between us all, tolerance, and the coming together of people here and for generations to come to build and achieve what is worthy of them. Rabin's remarks were no less emotional. As dawn broke this morning and a new day began, new life came into the world, he said. Babies were born in Jerusalem. Babies were born in Amman. But this morning is different. To the mother of the Jordanian newborn, a blessed day to you. To the mother of the Israeli newborn, a blessed day to you. The peace that was born today gives us the hope that children born today will never know war between us, and their mothers will know no sorrow. By attending the signing, Bill Clinton became the first American president to make an official visit to Jordan since 1974. And the day of the signing turned out to be Hillary's birthday. We had learned about it that morning and hurriedly ordered a cake. We celebrated the peace treaty and Hillary's birthday at lunch in Aqaba before going up to Amman, where the president presented a stirring address to a joint session of the Jordanian parliament. President Clinton's speech struck an important balance between the political and material rewards of the peace treaty, the forgiveness of Jordan's debt, development of the Rift Valley, expansion of trade and investment opportunities, and the spiritual gains. Echoing my husband's lifelong belief that what people have in common is more important than their differences, Clinton ended his remarks by quoting Moses' farewell address to the children of Israel as they gathered to cross the River Jordan. I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life, so that you and your descendants may live. He then cited a similar message of hope and religious tolerance from the Prophet Muhammad. There is no argument between us and you. God shall bring us together, and unto him is the homecoming. The metaphorical breaking down of boundaries was a tremendously positive step. The actual opening of the borders between our two countries, however, posed unforeseen problems. Immediately after the peace treaty, Jordan's archaeological treasure, Petra, was overrun by a massive influx of Israeli tourists. The narrow sick, or gorge, that served as an entrance to the Nabataean city became crowded with people and horses. The crush of visitors often exceeded the carrying capacity of the archaeological park and accelerated deterioration of the fragile sandstone of the ancient monuments. UNESCO had designated Petra a World Heritage Site in 1985. And well before the peace treaty, I had appealed to Federico Mayer, the Director General of UNESCO, to work with us to design a master plan for the entire region. Luxury hotels began to proliferate in Petra. 6 new 4-star and 5-star hotels within 2 years, with many more planned. This uncontrolled development was devastating to the area, because there was no requirement for an environmental impact assessment. Both the site and its income needed to be protected. The local Bedouin communities complained bitterly when we forbade horses in the sick, So we compromised by allowing them to provide horses for the trip between the tourist center and the entrance to the Sikh. The hotel owners were furious when, at UNESCO's urging, we raised the price of admission to around $30, and some foreign tourists were furious when we established a much lower price for Jordanians. Still, for all our efforts, which included the removal of tens of thousands of tons of rubble from the floor of the Sikh to stem erosion and reduce the danger of flash floods, by 1998, Petra would be listed as one of the World Monuments Fund 100 most endangered sites, and it remains on that list today. When my husband made his first public visit to Israel, in November, for the ceremonial signing of the ratification of the peace treaty, he flew to the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee by helicopter, and was greeted by hundreds of ecstatic Israeli schoolchildren shouting, "Hussein! Hussein!" An Israeli journalist commented that night on CNN that if my husband were running for election in Israel, he would win. Such remarks amused my husband, but did not sit well with conservative elements in Jordan and in other Arab countries. The change in Hussein after the success of the peace negotiations was unmistakable. When King Juan Carlos and Queen Sophie made a state visit to Jordan in November 1994, to coincide with Hussein's birthday, the first such official visit we had hosted since the Gulf crisis, he was far more relaxed than I had ever seen him under such circumstances. The Spanish royals presented us with a beautiful Andalusian mare in foal. A terrible sickness had befallen the Andalusians in Spain several years before, but now the breed had recovered enough for Sophie and Juanito to present us with this precious brood mare to join the stallion they had given us years earlier on our state visit to Spain. Hussein's mood grew even lighter when we returned to Aqaba after saying our farewells and went out on our fishing boat. He decided impulsively to cross the Israeli border into the waters off Eilat. Escorted by dolphins and a flotilla of local boats, Hussein was greeted by crowds of Israelis blowing kisses and cheering. "The atmosphere is electric and very neighborly," I wrote in my journal. "His spontaneity is fun, and our shared enjoyment of so many extraordinary experiences is the greatest gift of the advancing years of marriage." Later that same year, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, another staunchly loyal friend, made a state visit to Jordan. Beatrix, one of the warmest and kindest spirits I have ever known, assumed the Dutch throne when her mother, Queen Juliana, abdicated in 1980. The Queen and Prince Klaus had been our first royal visitors in the first years of our marriage and had always shown a deep understanding of the political, economic, and humanitarian challenges we faced. My husband's spirit remained high in England, where we joined Hashim, who was on Thanksgiving break from school in the United States, and Hamza, who had come over from Harrow, to spend the weekend with Prince Charles at Sandringham for a shooting party. That Sunday I remember watching my husband and the two boys walking the rolling hills in the requisite breeches and waistcoats and boots, and feeling so proud of my handsome men. In May 1995, we were back in London for the 50th anniversary of VE Day celebrations. As we pulled up to Buckingham Palace for the opening event, our car was placed first in line because Hussein, after so many years on the throne, had seniority over every other head of state in attendance. While we waited in the car, my husband reflected with some amazement that the first trip he had made as a monarch to England had been on the occasion of the death of King George, Queen Elizabeth's father. Then he had been the youngest leader, positioned at the end of the line. 40 years later, with innumerable crises and conflicts behind him, he was now the presiding elder statesman of all the guests. Chapter 19. The Edge of the Abyss. I was in Swaziland when I heard the news. I had been attending the United World Colleges International Council meeting in Johannesburg, South Africa, where I was officially inaugurated as the Global Education Movement's president, succeeding Prince Charles, alongside President Nelson Mandela, who was assuming responsibility for the movement's International Council. At the end of the Johannesburg meeting, we visited our United World College, Waterford Kamhlaba in Swaziland, which had provided the best equal opportunity education for more than a generation of South African and Swazi students during the restrictive years of apartheid, educating, among others, Nelson Mandela's children and grandchildren. The energetic young Swazi king Mswati accompanied me to the school and later hosted a colorful official banquet for us. Upon returning to my hotel suite from dinner, I received an urgent message that my husband had called. Moments later, I reached Hussein, who told me Yitzhak Rabin had just been shot. Nothing more was known. I put down the receiver and sat there alone in the sitting room, absolutely stunned. But I clung to the hope that Rabin would pull through. Shortly afterward, Hussein phoned again. Shaken and sorrowful, he said Rabin was dead, assassinated by an Israeli. I tried to comfort him and said I would return home immediately. King Mswati was extremely understanding and considerate, opening the airport at 6 the next morning for my departure and to bid me farewell. The king and I flew to Jerusalem for Rabin's funeral. It was Hussein's first visit there since the 1967 war. As a wife and a mother, I felt deeply for Leah Rabin. I could not help thinking, "There but for the grace of God go I," as we condoled her and her stricken family. King Hussein's words on that day resonated around the world. He had courage, he had vision, and he had a commitment to peace. Standing here, I commit myself before you, before my people in Jordan, before the world, to myself to continue with our utmost effort to ensure that we leave a similar legacy. We are not ashamed, nor are we afraid, nor are we anything but determined to fulfill the legacy for which my friend fell, as did my grandfather in this very city, when I was with him and but a young boy. Later, I would be criticized by some in our area for showing sadness at the death of Rabin, an Israeli. But in fact, I was not alone. People from all faiths from throughout our region and elsewhere in the world mourned the passing of a statesman who had essentially given his life for peace. Hussein was filled with foreboding over the impact that Rabin's loss would have on the peace process. Hopes had been raised over what was widely being called the peace dividend, the chance to realize great gains not just in the diplomatic arena, but for positive national development as well. Our society, held hostage for so many years by conflict, now had a chance to move ahead, it seemed. My husband and I hoped and expected that this easing of tensions would encourage a broader participation and investment in the building of our country and the strengthening of its institutions. I returned to Amman deeply sobered by the death of Rabin and all the implications it carried, but more determined than ever to continue my efforts to build bridges between communities and cultures. King Hussein always emphasized that true peace is not created by treaties between governments, but must be built between people. And to bring people together, we had to begin with our children. The only way to overcome the enmity of previous generations is to enable the next generation, the future guardians of peace, to meet and interact openly and honestly in a secure atmosphere of trust. Education and exposure can impress upon young people the importance of resolving conflicts without violence, teach them the skills with which to do it, and to make their voices heard in issues that affect them. What if we today placed a premium on education for peace, a commitment to it equal to what previous generations devoted to military academies and combat readiness? We might well achieve a more lasting security than war could ever provide. With these goals paramount, I became actively involved in the 1990s with three inspiring programs that promote cross-cultural understanding and conflict resolution by bringing together young people and potential world leaders from across our region and the world to understand and build on their common humanity. Since 1993, Seeds of Peace has been bringing children from the Middle East and other conflict-wracked regions together in the summer to provide them an opportunity to break down the barriers of prejudice and build mutual respect. Its founder, John Wallach, believed that this process would encourage its participants to realize, in his words, that the enemy has a face. Seeds is producing a significant network of future leaders and activists for peace who value communication over confrontation. One graduate, a Palestinian youngster named Asel Asle, was wearing his Seeds of Peace t-shirt when he was killed on a West Bank street by Israeli crossfire. But his family refused to allow their despair to turn to hate or to abandon what their son believed in. They welcomed his Jewish friends into their home and to the funeral to mourn with them. Other Seeds graduates are reaching out to each other in the midst of the violence. Hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians use the Seeds network to write emails or to call each other, whether to trade passionate opinions or to provide comfort over the sound of gunfire, or even to risk their lives to meet at the Seeds of Peace Center in Jerusalem. In their actions and their words, they plead with us all not to give up hope, never to surrender in the fight for peace. Hussein and I often met with the young participants, who were an enduring source of hope for him, especially during some of the most frustrating and painful periods of the peace process. United World Colleges is a global network of international baccalaureate schools, which foster cross-cultural understanding, peace, and tolerance, ideals even more relevant in today's conflict-scarred world than when the first college opened following World War II. Each campus brings students together from countries throughout the world to live, study, and serve the community together. They break down barriers and weave their regional and national perspectives into a complex tapestry of understanding. As one UWC graduate said, "When you come into the school, you have an idea of how things are, but then you have all your ideas broken down. You start to learn how to pick out the truth, start to see the truth from other people's points of view. That is how you change the world." The enthusiasm, commitment, and solidarity I see in their eyes is my vision of hope and peace. There are 10 United World Colleges spanning the globe, and we were all committed to the dream of a UWC in the Middle East, to bring together students from throughout the region and the world. We chose a spectacular site in Aqaba for its symbolic value as it overlooked Jordan, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, and was close to the Palestinian territory. Now, perhaps more than ever, a UWC of the Middle East could contribute to our efforts to educate a new generation of architects of peace. Such architects were already being trained at the United Nations University International Leadership Academy in Amman, the first global leadership training facility designed to enhance international cooperation through dialogue and intercultural exchange, which we officially launched on the United Nations 50th anniversary. The brainchild of our former Prime Minister, Abdel Salam Majali, the UNU-ILA, brought together young professionals to share ideas, experiences, and viewpoints with each other and with current world leaders. In an atmosphere of dialogue and cultural exchange, they gained the skills, but more important, the open, flexible minds, so vital to the leaders of the future. Jordanian girls and women often excel in these programs, which I find especially encouraging because in my experience, whenever women engage as equal partners with men, development and progress accelerate and endure. I had been deeply involved in women's issues since my marriage, but the scope of my understanding expanded exponentially through such programs as Bani Hamida and the National Handicrafts Development Project, our Quality of Life and Microcredit programs, and the Institute for Child Health and Development, under the aegis of the Nur al-Hussein Foundation. In our women's programs, we had worked closely with two national organizations, the General Federation of Jordanian Women, which focused on the political, economic, and social status of women, and the Business and Professional Women's Club, which promoted the advancement of women in the workplace. Over the decades, the status of women in Jordan had significantly improved. The percentage of women in the workforce had doubled, and gradual legislative improvements were being made. Although men and women receive equal education in Jordan, women still tended to enter the workforce in relatively small numbers. The obstacles that keep many women in Jordan from realizing their full potential were a great source of frustration for many of us, particularly the king. The waste of underutilizing half the country's population was not limited to Jordan, of course. Years after the women's movement had made significant gains in the great democracy of America, there were still precious few women in appointed or elected positions. Indeed, it was not until the 1980 presidential elections that brought Ronald Reagan to office that the gender gap was first publicly acknowledged. In Jordan, many women focused their talents and energies on responsibility.